New data points to racial disparity in coronavirus vaccine rollouts in the U.S. Blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities receive fewer doses. Germany adopts more strict measures, including travel bans, amid concerns over a surge in more contagious variants of COVID-19. People in Spain's Catalonia head to the polls for regional parliamentary elections that will test the strength of pro-independence parties. I'm Alex Ajafe. It's good to have you with us. Top story, beginning with the U.S. new data there indicating that the country is struggling with racial disparities in COVID immunization. Blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities are receiving fewer doses of vaccines in Washington state. The data released by the state's health department suggests that just a quarter of Hispanics have received the vaccine, despite accounting for 13.2% of Washington population. Among other ethnic groups that make up 4.3% of the state's population, just 0.3% have been fully vaccinated. By contrast, 66% of whites have been administered the vaccine so far. There have been similar reports from other states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Mississippi, and Florida, suggesting that blacks are receiving vaccinations at dramatically lower rates than white Americans. A CNN analysis of five metro areas, including Chicago, Atlanta, and Houston, show a similar trend against blacks and Hispanics. The U.S. Senate has voted to acquit former President Donald Trump, sparing him from conviction in a second impeachment trial in a year.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, upon one article of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present, not having found him guilty of the charge contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charge in said article.
The upper chamber of Congress voted 57 guilty against 43 not guilty. That fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to convict the former president. Trump was accused of inciting an insurrection on the Capitol last month as lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden as the next president. Despite his acquittal, a bipartisan majority cast votes found Trump guilty. In a statement, Trump, however, called the trial the greatest witch hunt in U.S. history. He said that his political movement has just begun. Biden said that the substance of the charges against Trump is not in question despite his acquittal, and that was echoed by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer also slammed a vote to exonerate Trump as un-American. He said that the 43 senators who voted not guilty will forever be linked to Trump's, quote, terrible legacy. Democrats had warned that acquitting the former president would open the door for future presidents to violate their office in the final weeks of their presidency without suffering any accountability. Colin Campbell, our D.C. correspondent, joined us a short while ago and briefed us on the outcome of Trump's impeachment trial.
The Senate voted to acquit the president, the former president, and I think that was to be expected. This whole week, we've been listening to testimony from both sides and the widespread criticism of the former president's defense team as they cobbled together an argument that at times seemed rambling and unfocused, but at other times just seemed somewhat sophomoric, especially in the montage of the word fight, which was part of their defense. The whole time, people knew, most everyone knew, that the president, former president, would be acquitted and that he would not be convicted. There are only 7 Republicans who joined Democrats, far short of the 17 that they needed. And I believe that many didn't even think that they would get 7 at times. There was this argument that the former president couldn't be put on trial because he was not the president anymore, and impeachment was focused on presidents or people who are still holding office. But there was precedent that had already been set that not everyone who is found guilty to be impeached needed to be in office. But the Republicans largely did not want to believe that. They did not want to accept that in part of their decision making. And one could only think that it's mostly partisan, that they still wanted to show that they were in alignment with Trump, that they supported the Republican Party, and they didn't want to face a lot of their constituents who they would have a lot of questions to answer if they had voted to convict former President Trump.
Now, in other news, Germany has adopted more strict measures, including travel bans, amid concerns about a surge in more contagious variants of the coronavirus. Authorities have banned travel from Czech border regions and also the state in Austria. 1,000 police officers have been mobilized to ensure strict border controls. The state-owned rail company also suspended services to and from the affected areas. In late January, Germany banned most travelers from countries classed as so-called mutation areas, or places hardest hit by new and more contagious COVID variants. While those include Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and Portugal. Only a handful of exceptions are allowed to enter Germany from those countries, including returning Germans and essential workers such as doctors. In Catalonia, people are heading for the polls for regional and parliamentary elections. They're expected to test the strength of the Spanish region's pro-independence movement. Pro-independence parties, who are now in power in the region, are competing with socialists who lead Spain's central government. Recent opinion polls showed socialists who oppose independence are slightly ahead. The vote is an important signal of an appeal by pro-independence groups and could affect the political trajectory of their movement. If separatists manage to retain control of the regional parliament, a new independence declaration appears very unlikely due to divisions among parties. The turnout is expected to be low due to the coronavirus. Also, our correspondent, Cusack Edry, says that the coronavirus pandemic would affect the voter turnout in Catalonia's parliamentary election.
This election is happening in the midst of a pandemic. Even the elements seem to be against it. This is a very rainy day across the region, so that would be another element to take into account when people have to decide whether they will go out, show at the polls and vote, or stay at home. Some 5.5 registered voters are expected to cast their ballots today. The big unknown is how many of those registered voters will eventually show up at the polls. Polling stations have opened at 9 in the morning today, some with a delay due to one big handicap that's facing election officials, which is the lack of supervisors. Not all polling stations have supervisors. The situation is so critical that people, the supervisors themselves, fearing the fact that they may be infected, have preferred to stay home or to miss out on the election. The government has given a press conference a short while ago assuring people that they will be, that all the polling tables will be constituted before the end of this morning. That will remain to be seen. There were very, very strict measures in place.
It's time for the News Review program. Do stay with us. Ten years have passed since an uprising roared into life in Bahrain against an undemocratic regime. People in the Persian Gulf Kingdom still hold rallies, though sporadic, to make their voices heard and to condemn the ruling Al Khalifa's crackdown on their popular movement. Bahraini people seem adamant in their pursuit of reform on the anniversary of the 2011 revolution. We have a report on that.
February 14, 2011 was the beginning of an uprising in Bahrain that brought tens of thousands of people to the streets across the tiny island to call for reform. But the peaceful movement soon turned bloody when the Al Khalifa dynasty began to quell demonstrations with an iron fist. Backed by forces deployed from Saudi Arabia in the early months of the uprising and mercenaries from other countries, the Bahraini regime launched a brutal clampdown. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries, but those outcries failed to stop a kingdom that hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet.
The United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region. And so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power so that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there.
Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party, Al-Wafaq, in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. It also revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people, including prominent cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. From the Iranian city of Qom, the 84-year-old spiritual leader marked the uprising anniversary via televised address.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising, and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands, and they have a great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take.
He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al Khalifa regime. He noted that the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country. On the eve of the uprising anniversary, Bahrainis staged nationwide rallies, including in the capital Manama, and renewed their call for the downfall of King Hamad and his monarchy. The demonstrators also demanded that all political prisoners be freed. 10 years after the first wave of demonstrations rocked Bahrain, people are still hoping that their resistance would bring about democratic reforms, progress on human rights, as well as accountability for past and present abuses.
Okay, with that report, let's now invite one of our guests to see what she thinks about all of this. So Fatima Yazbek, human rights activist, is joining us out of Melbourne. Good to have you with us on the show, lady. So you just heard the report, and you saw the Bahraini people out there, and this is while 10 years passed since the uprising that they had in their country. Still, they are there, and they're trying to cry out and talk about their voices of dissent. So what is this indicative of?
I want to congratulate the Bahraini people on their courage to keep demanding their rightful demands for 10 years, to keep speaking out and to keep calling out the government and asking to have their legal rights. The continuous uprising or the continuous demonstrations for 10 years now today indicates how the will of the Bahraini people and indicates how much the government or Al Khalifa are oppressors and how much they want to control the country. Through these 10 years, we've seen so much violation, we've seen so much oppression, but the people kept on demonstrating, kept on protesting, and kept on demanding their rights. And as I said, that shows us how much they are willing to change, and how much they were oppressed, and how much they are sick of that oppression now that they need to change the current situation.
Okay. Now, from Beirut, we are also joined by another guest. We have Gena Rabai, researcher with the Bahrain Forum for Human Rights. Good to have you with us, Gena. So, how do you look at this? Tell us what the Bahraini people want, what their demands are, and the way that the Al Khalifa regime has treated them.
After 10 years since the beginning of the uprising in Bahrain, and with the demonstrations and different forms of protest still going on, in over 80 regions in Bahrain, whether cities, towns, villages, since they cannot make one mass protest in Al Manama anymore after the oppression in 2011, in spite of the authorities' suppressions on those protests, I would say a suitable title for this uprising would be Peaceful Demands, stressing on the word peaceful. For 10 years, the Bahraini people never backed off from demanding their rights, but always maintained peacefulness in their method. On the other hand, you asked me how the authorities react. On the other hand, what were the reactions of the authorities towards those peaceful protests? We can see that the authorities always reacted with oppression and violations of basic rights. There have been more than 15,000 prisoners of conscience, among whom there were more than 1,500 minors and more than 200 women along the 10 years of the uprising. Those prisoners faced severe torture in investigations and ill treatment in prisons and were arbitrary sentenced, not to forget 5 executions that were carried out only for the crime of demanding rights. That's what the people want. You ask me, the people want their rights, their basic rights, whether they're political representation, and just like to be like any citizens in the world.
Right.
Anyway, also over 12,200 raids have been carried out in areas and homes just in the past 3 years. All of that oppression, and the people still fully determined insist on the peacefulness and the continuity of the protest, whether the leadership of the opposition in Bahrain, of the opposition movements in Bahrain, as we heard yesterday in Sheikh Isa Qasim's speech, or the popular base.
Right. Okay, let's go back to Melbourne. Fatima, you know that the things that have been going on in Bahrain, they are not receiving much coverage by especially Western media. What were the reasons for this? Is Bahrain not part of the planet?
Yeah, the first reason is that the oppression or the campaigns that the Bahraini authorities carried out on media and on journalists and on activists. Like, they shut down the only independent newspaper in the country, Al Wasat, and they closed all their offices. So there is no independent media outlets in the country to report on what's going in the country. But why is the Western media turning a blind eye towards what's happening in Bahrain? I believe it's as we always say, that the Bahraini authorities won't be able to continue their oppression without having backing up from the Western government or their Western allies, like the United States. The previous United States administration were encouraging the Bahraini government and the Saudi government as well to continue their oppression to their people. After Trump's first and last visit to the Middle East, after he met the officials in Saudi Arabia, we've seen that in the second day, the Bahraini government targeted Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim and revoked his citizenship, forced him to travel out of the country.
Okay. Thank you very much for your contribution and comments. We had Ghanar Obai, researcher with Bahrain Forum for Human Rights, who joined us from Beirut. And also Fatima Yazba, human rights activist out of Melbourne. And that's it for this edition of the News Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell bonded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
The plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border,
and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there. So why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he'd bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in the Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence, and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II, the film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma, showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know is once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
Well, the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood.
But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyi al-azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We've been studying different features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and after studying the necessity of being balanced, being truthful, being united, we talked about the necessity of observing the rights of each mu'min. And we said there are lots of rights that mu'minin should observe, and these are indeed to keep the community together and form a very solid, united community, like one body, as Rasulullah said, that the example of mu'minin in their love, in their sympathy, in their affection is like one jasad. مَثَلُ الْمُؤْمَنِينَ فِي تَوَادِّهِمْ وَتَرَاحُمْهِمْ وَتَعَاطُفِهِمْ كَمَثَلِ جَسَدٍ. It's like one body. Different cells and organs of the same body. I want now to mention a very important hadith, and then inshallah we move on to another characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and that is to do Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar. This hadith is a very important hadith in Mustadrak, قال قلت لأبي عبد الله عليه السلام ما حق المؤمن على المؤمن What is the right of mu'min over another mu'min? Imam said, إِنَّ مِنْ حَقِّ الْمُؤْمِنَ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِ الْمَوَدَّةَ لَهُ فِي صَدْرِهِ The first thing is that you should love your brothers and sisters. There must be real love in your chest for them. وَإِذَا قَالَ لَهُ أَنْتَ عَدُوِّي If God forbids, it goes higher. Say, you are my enemy. I'm going to fight you. I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to damage your reputation. I'm going to do something with you that no one is going to vote for you again. I'm going to do something that no one marries you. Then Imam said, فَقَدْ كَفَرَ And at least one of them, فَقَدْ كَفَرَ أَحَدُ At least one side is kafir. Maybe both sides are kafir, but at least one is kafir. So this is the amount of respect that mu'min has. And if in community we observe this respect, how united and how close our community become. No one can penetrate and do fitna in this community, whether from inside or outside. Because everyone is 100% careful about others. وَإِذَا تَهَمَهُ If he accuses him of something, of a sin, of a crime, انماث الإيمان في قلبه كما ينماث الملح في الماء. Iman will melt, will be disappearing, like putting salt in water. When you put salt in water, salt will be melt and will disappear, will be resolved. His iman will be finished. If I accuse a mu'min of the thing that he has not done.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true. Always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all opened our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So we have to be very careful. We are not dealing with ordinary people. We are dealing with mu'minin. Even with respect to ordinary people, we have to be careful. With respect to animals, we have to be careful. Even Imam Ali says, to do zulm to an ant is so great that if you give me all the seven continents and the sky, I'm not going to do it. Even doing zulm to an ant. But mu'min is another thing. If you do zulm to mu'min, if you destroy the reputation of a mu'min, you are declaring war with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we have to be very careful. May Allah also keep me to be very careful because I have great responsibility. As an alim, my responsibility is more. Please pray for me. So we all have to observe this. So, a community of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam is a community that mutual love, friendship, affection, tender keeps them together. And they don't let anyone to divide. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that one requirement of this wilaya is Amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar.
المؤمنون والمؤمنات بعضهم أولياء بعض يأمرون بالمعروف وينهون عن المنكر. Because they have wilaya, they have right over each other, they feel responsible for each other. What happens to you is important for me. I cannot say I don't bother. So if there is any way to help you, I have to help you. If you forget, I have to remind you. If you don't do something which is good and you are missing, I have to tell you. The same, you also should do the same with me if I forget. It's not, Amr bi Ma'ruf is not because someone is superior and another person is inferior. No, it's mutual. If a person who is 90 years old does something wrong, a person who is 15 years old should tell him. And also vice versa. An alim, if does something wrong, you go and say, you have forgotten this, you have made some mistake. And also a person who is a lay person. This is mutual. All mu'mineen have responsibility to enjoin the good and prohibit the bad. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, this is the only way to be saved from loss. إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرٍ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَتَبَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَبَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. This is the only way. No one can say, I am very alert, I am very pious, I am very careful, I don't need anyone to monitor me, to observe me, to advise me. We are all in need of advice.
I'm looking back throughout the years. To breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
That was the Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of His way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi,
Let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again. Let's become.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.